Now entering the Bitcoin Podcast Network.
Back everybody to Hashing It Out. As always, I'm your host, Dr. Corey Petty, and my co-host today is Dean Eigenman. Say what's up, everybody, Dean.
What's up, everybody?
Dean. You've ruined it. We have to make a new thing now. Anyway, guest today, you've heard him before. You'll probably hear him again. We're talking with Ava Labs, and from them, we have Stefan Budolf. How do you say your last name? Budolf?
Yeah, so Stephen Budolf. Yeah, it's like Budolf. Rudolph, but with a butt in front of it. Yeah,
nice. You said that before.
Oh yeah.
And Kevin Seknicki. Why don't we start off by allowing you guys to introduce yourselves? Kevin, you start, and we'll go with Stefan after that.
Hey, I've been on this show before. It seems like I just can't go away, but you also can't. You guys keep bringing me here, so it's your fault. To your audience listeners that are tired of me already, blame Corey, not me.
Hey, you've been an inside man for so long.
Again, blame Corey. Very brief introduction. I'm Kevin Seknicki, a background in tech, initially in cryptography. Was into cryptocurrencies way back ago. Got in it basically a few months after the client came out, but was never really in the crypto Twitter circles for a very long time. Got involved in cryptography research, then went to my PhD, did the distributed systems research. And then went on to work on the business side of things with Ava, and do mostly business side things nowadays. But obviously, I have a technical background, so I get involved as much as I can on the technical things nowadays. But it's not much.
Stefan, what about you?
I'm Stephen Budolf. So I got into crypto around in high school. I implemented like a little like margin trading, like trading bot on like Poloniex in like high school. And so that's like how I got in, like right around the time like ETH was first starting to launch. And then I went to Cornell University and took a couple of Goons classes and kind of got more interested in both what he was doing and also kind of the space on a more technical side rather than financial. I started doing research with Goon, and then he put me on to implementing a Go version of the Avalanche protocol, which has turned into the Gecko client for ABBA. And so so that's basically where I've been working for the past like 2 years in August, I guess. So yeah,
I kind of feel like Goon's previous CompSci curriculum was a recruitment machine for ABBA. Am I wrong there?
I don't know. Like he did a lot of system stuff, which is like very related, but not specifically like blockchain related. But he did teach specifically a cryptocurrency blockchain like intro course, which I feel like he was definitely looking to like, you know, feel out the crowd and see both like the interest level in it and also like if there's like any people to do research. But
yeah, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that as a negative thing. That's a perfect pool of people to be choosing from and trying to get people to work on distributed systems.
If Ava Labs is any indication, I think we have quite a few ex-Cornell people. So you know, we've definitely used Goon's outreach there. So yeah, for sure.
Were you part of IC3, Stephen?
I actually wasn't part of IC3. I've like since like starting research with Goon, I've done like more IC3 things, but I actually was not part of IC3 before working with Goon.
So I think it's reasonable. Before we start diving into any technicals or changes or what's going on right now with Ava Labs, to give a brief kind of technical landscape of what Ava is and how it differentiates itself from the other open permissionless blockchains.
Stephen, do you want to take that?
So I'll start, and I'm sure that you'll have a bunch of like
Of course.
So ABBA first differentiates itself with its consensus protocol, which I know we've talked about a lot before on at least previous episodes of this, but I'll give a very brief overview of essentially it's, you know, highly scalable, both in throughput and also in the in latency and the number of participants that can participate in consensus. So the first kind of main idea that started ABBA was the consensus protocol. Now, since then, we've also branched out into this idea of subnets or like a heterogeneous network. And so that allows us to kind of scale, not just like on like consensus speed sides, but also it allows people to kind of develop their own personalized network. So for example, we are able to port the EVM so easily because we can essentially just have a wrapper around an existing EVM implementation and then use Avalanche consensus with that. And so we can port things into Gecko in a relatively easy manner because of how we've structured our subnets. And so that lets people not just have a very fast infrastructure, but also a very flexible one. So someone could implement their own virtual machine that has kind of arbitrary business logic that's specific to them. So those are like the two technical side. I think Kevin can talk a lot more about like the business side and how we're kind of like pitching to be unique in that aspect. But I think from the architecture side, we're kind of pushing towards like a very flexible infrastructure, both on the consensus and on the engine side.
Yeah. So, before Kevin goes, I want to try and reiterate something that I think is incredibly important about what ABBA is doing. And that is it's a marked distinction between consensus and the underlying data or machine state, right? Most open networks right now, those two things are like intrinsically married. Like the consensus relies on the state and the change of state. Whereas like ABBA and its differentiation is consensus is its own thing. And then you can have other, like a bunch of different machines rely on that consensus engine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's basically exactly right. It's programmability, not just at the application layer, which is what other smart contract platforms do allow you to do already. It's also programmability at layers below that, at the network stack, effectively in the data stack, so which is an important property. So it allows us to do some interesting things that are very difficult for others. I mean, one of the most important things that we want to make sure is that we build a smart contract platform that capitalizes on the value of the applications built on top. This is something that Ethereum, for example, doesn't do. If I issue a let me call it a low velocity, high longevity type of asset, something like real estate or land title or something like that, on Ethereum looks no different than, forgive my nomenclature here, but any regular old shitcoin. It accumulates the same fees. It does not. It is not guaranteed to be different from any other coin that does maybe has no value whatsoever to it. And we're trying to capitalize on this problem in a way that provides or that gives the issuers of assets and creators of smart contracts on our platform the ability to effectively divide the guarantees a little bit more at a higher granularity or lower granularity rather. It's about giving somebody that is issuing these applications that or these assets that have very high longevity needs and high security needs. It gives them an ability to pay much, much larger fees to be stored for a very long period of time and be very secure versus something that maybe is just, not very high value and needs maybe much higher speed and much lower fees. So this is something that we allow that Ethereum doesn't quite allow. And this actually goes down to the ABBA token design as well. So in Ethereum, the problem is it does not, if I issue a new token or if I build a really successful application on Ethereum, fees out are paid in ETH, which is great, but down to the miners and nobody else benefits from the fact that there is usage of this token on the system. It's actually quite a big problem for Ethereum. I mean, you have so much value being built on Ethereum that Bitcoin could ever dream of right now. And none of it is really being capitalized at the value that it should be capitalized by the underlying Ethereum token. You know, our design has been more of the design that we've taken is more of the one that says, look, this is a capped supply token like Bitcoin. And whenever you do operations that require things like creating of new blockchains and paying for transaction fees and so on, they burn AVA tokens. And the burning of AVA tokens ultimately creates scarcity in AVA. And so that capitalizes on the underlying token of the system. So that's a different design from how Ethereum has done this. But I mean, that's more of a, I would say, peripheral property. The first goal that we want to achieve is really in the ability to effectively allow programmability at the network and data layer, which is very, very important because it allows a lot of flexibility on how you can design your economics for your smart contract. It's like effectively, you know, smart contract level sharding, almost, if you want to think of it that way. Maybe that's not quite super correct, but it's the best analogy that I can possibly come up with in one sentence. And that's just not the case for any other platform that we've seen out there.
Okay. So Stephen, you mentioned these subnets that AVA has, right? How do those compare? Would you compare those? Are those akin to parachains or something like shards in ETH2? So with the stateless model that you mentioned, how does that compare to something like ETH2, which also has the goal of being more stateless?
Yeah, so I think the biggest difference between, you know, our model and something more similar to their model is that for us, our subnets are heterogeneous, which means that they aren't necessarily running the same VM or the same I guess schema if you're coming from database land. So ETH2, at least, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but ETH2 is planning on achieving scalability on the same kind of network with the same security guarantees and the same network guarantees across all of its shards. So what that means is that essentially they're trying to parallelize computation and increase their throughput by having nodes not need to validate the entire state. And so that's very useful in some cases. However, it's typically pretty difficult when there's a lot of like cross-shard communication, which on a blockchain, it then becomes very important of how you're splitting things into shards. And so, you know, from our point of view, you know, you're going to have something like, you know, the DAI chain or the DAI, I guess, shard, where, you know, everyone wants to be on the DAI shard because everyone wants to use DAI. And so all of a sudden, anyone that isn't on the DAI shard is going to have to be communicating with the DAI shard, which is relatively expensive in most sharded systems. However, with us, our viewpoint with subnets is that subnets are heterogeneous, and so they contain their own environment. So, for example, the EVM would live in its own subnet and would kind of, or so for us, like Ethereum is a subnet that we're planning on doing, which is a spoon of Ethereum state. So that's like the big difference, really. So we have subnets based off of the functionality rather than, you know, just splitting the entire state. So that's like the main difference. Now, to answer like your stateless kind of point, so stateless is kind of a different beast entirely. So it's very important when you're building a blockchain system that you have to understand that this thing's going to be alive for hopefully an extremely long period of time. So it's an ever-growing database. You can think of it that way. So you need to be able to kind of prune out things that are no longer viable or like needed. So Bitcoin does this by using UTXOs. And so you only really need to care about the current UTXO set. As long as you can bootstrap into the current UTXO set, then you're able to kind of process transactions and make progress. Now, there are like client-side security guarantees that, you know, may require you to bootstrap the entire chain. But we've seen that many people don't actually require that level of security. Now, it's, you know, still totally possible in everything we're doing, but I think for the happy path, most people don't care. But there's other things that something like Ethereum does, which is account-based rather than UTXO-based. And so that actually isn't prunable. So what that means is that whenever someone uses an account, that state actually can never get removed. Otherwise, you would have a replay attack potential. So so there's like those kinds of decisions that go into VMs to make it so that you can have a an easy bootstrap in and an easy sync. But that's kind of almost orthogonal to subnets in like the overall idea.
So I guess subnets are probably more comparable to parachains in the Polkadot model than to shards in the Ethereum model from your summary.
I don't know. I don't know a ton about Polkadot, so I'll be straight up with that. But yeah.
I think the quickest summary of parachains in Polkadot is that essentially it's just a heterogeneous blockchain that's connected over this layer above, which is the Polkadot network.
Not quite. So first of all, the Polkadot network has shared security. We don't. That's first. Second of all, the way to think of the subnet abstraction is that all the subnet is a collection of validators. That's all it is. It's just a collection of validators. It's a set. So a subnet can actually have multiple chains internally, and each chain can have multiple different virtual machines. Really, what this abstraction provides you is who gets to the first layer abstraction, very, very high layer, is A, who gets to manage your data. And then within that abstraction, you get to say, how is my data managed? So the who gets to manage my data is the subnet component that defines a set of validators. And then once you answer that question, it can be permissioned or it can be fully permissionless. You can say that this subnet is anybody can validate it. There is no requirements whatsoever for it. Or you can say that only special types of entities can validate it. And then once you answer that question, you have to answer the question of, okay, I am within this particular subnet. What is the mode or how are we managing the data? So we answer the who manages the data. Now we have to answer how are we managing the data? And the how is answered via any arbitrary collection of chains that can exist within the subnet, which implement any arbitrary virtual machine. That's the abstraction here. It's really, there is effectively zero, there is nothing that's forced down anybody's throat here. It's just, you have full control over everything. You get to manage whatever, everything in however way you want. So if I want to launch a new subnet that represents, real estate, holdings, assets, then, that's trivial to do. And, that's not quite the same as, for example, just having a parachain, which is just a single blockchain, I believe, just a single linear chain. And that parachain happens to implement maybe different execution environments. So maybe EVM versus something else, or maybe WASM. I'm not sure how many execution environments they support. But that's the extent of the customizability of parachains. There's no more to it.
So what binds these subnets together? Like what makes it a subnet different from just another Avalanche network that someone created randomly? Are subnets able to communicate with each other, or is a subnet just a fancy word for a new network?
No. Okay, got it. Yeah, so they are able to communicate with each other. They're able to interoperate. That interoperation is not works out of the box, regardless of the virtual machine. There needs to be some wrappings done, but it should be pretty straightforward. The communication is the part here that matters. So these subnets can communicate with each other. Typically speaking, because a lot of them would share the same set of validators, they probably would, the communication would be pretty trivial. But the thing here is that, you know, we're not trying to solve for a shared security model, because we think the shared security model is just not something that that makes sense. So to us, it's more of like give freedom and responsibility of the subnet creators themselves to figure out who manages this thing. And if they want the security of like a fully permissionless chain that's out there in public, then they can just launch on the default Ava subnet. That one would be permissionless and they can deploy on that one. But if they require more customizability, then they can create their own.
Correct me if I'm wrong here.
So you have these.
I want to get some type of make sure I'm right here. there are default subnets on Ava as it currently stands, and these are mandatory to be a part of if you'd like to have a different subnet. Is that true? I think it used to be that way. Is it still that way? And what are these subnets?
So it's just one default subnet is the main Ava default subnet, is the permissionless one. So if you want to be part of the interoperability network, you're going to have to be part of the main Ava subnet. But otherwise, there is no other sort of enforcements being done here. So that this enforcement is really to just make sure that Ava, the default Ava subnet, maintains a high degree of security guarantee in the permission.
What do you do on the Ava subnet? Like, what's the purpose of it, and how does it give you that ability to have interoperability?
The Ava subnet is the permissionless one. It's the one that it's supposed to be the default one. Does most of the operations of that you would think of Bitcoin or Ethereum and so on. That default subnet also provides some atomic swap operations that are needed for different other non-default subnets. So any other subnets that come in the future, if they want the interoperability, that interoperability comes by basically posting some transactions on the default Ava subnet. It's effectively as a checkpointing mechanism, quick one. So that's where the default Ava subnet comes in. It's just a coordination ledger effectively.
Yeah, just to jump in really quickly here. So in order for atomic swaps to be reasonable, both of the subnets that are trying to perform the swap need to know like who the validators are of the other network. And so the platform chain that is running on the default subnet acts as kind of like a shared space for those subnets to interact. So that's kind of how we enable atomic swaps across these two different subnets.
So the Ava chain here is kind of akin to like the Beacon chain in ETH2. It's a message passing system. Is that a correct statement?
I would say they're very similar, but
very similar. Yes, but they don't have the same functionality. The Beacon chain has it shuffles things around. It provides some randomness. Yeah. This is not the case. So it's a reduced functionality Beacon chain. That would be a good way to describe it.
And so if I want to do message passing, I just have to actually connect to the Ava subnet so that the Ava subnet can delegate messages to these different subnets.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So it's like the postal service essentially.
Effectively. Yeah. And the main Ava subnet also has the metadata chain, which is effectively a list of all of the active subnets. It's just a registry of all that's active right now, who's validating what. If you want to, you know, connect to another subnet, you want to know who's the latest set of validators, you basically just check with the main Ava subnet. That's where the reference point is.
How is this metadata stored? Is it in the blocks, or is it in a smart contract?
I think it's in the blocks. Steven can probably answer more on that.
Yeah, it's basically in the blocks. Like it's a very thin VM. Like it doesn't have like, it's not like a very flexible VM like Ethereum with like Solidity. It basically just allows for a couple different transaction formats. One's like, you know, add myself as a staker, you know, add myself to the subnet, create a new blockchain. That's basically all the platform chain does. So
the state you're tracking on that is basically just the current state of subnets and who's tracking them.
Correct. Yeah.
I didn't mean to say state so many times there, but it just comes out. is there a limit to how many subnets that can exist? Like with Polkadot, there's a limit. There's a limit of parachains. And then people like basically are vying for their ability to use the shared security model of the Polkadot network. Is that the case here?
No. You can create as many as you, you can create any arbitrary number of subnets and chains and so on, as long as you can pay for it.
Yeah. Pay for it.
Yeah, like submit a transaction that has the fees required to make it happen, because creating a new subnet is an expensive operation.
And that's is
there?
Yes.
How's the cost model work for that? Is it a fixed price, or does it get exponentially more expensive?
Yeah, I mean, that can get very complicated. So we currently have a very dumb model of just fixed price. Eventually, we're going to make it very, very sophisticated. So one thing at a time. There's only so many battles we can fight at the same time.
Yeah, in the long run, we'll probably want to have some sort of rent-based model because maintaining that state is just going to keep growing. So we'll want to be able to remove it. So we'll probably want to go to some like rent-based model for that. But right now, it's just a straight fee, pretty dumb.
Yeah. I mean, not just retaining state, but you have the problem of like every subnet added will add pressure onto the AVA subnet, right? Because every time a cross-shard transaction is done, that would have to happen through the AVA chain. So the more of these subnets you have, the more potential for transactions through this chain would grow.
Sure. I mean, like the atomic transactions will likely have fees as well. So that's not as big of a concern, but it's more just like the fact that the subnet exists and is being tracked by the chain.
So would transactions in a subnet be paid in a specific subnet token or also in AVA?
Transactions inside of a subnet can have no fees. They can do basically whatever they want as long as the validators for that subnet are happy with it.
Okay.
So yeah, it can so then if anything.
If a transaction then goes from subnet to another subnet and requires to have a fee paid on the AVA chain to have that cross-shard transaction relayed, how would that work in fees?
So the actual atomic transaction requires fees. So something posted to the platform chain would require a fee.
But so even if they had the same validator set, correct? Even if they have the same validator set, say for instance, like me and five buddies decided we want to make two chains, I don't know why that so I said that, but like just two different subnets that basically have, you know, maybe separate functionality. We have one for kind of smart contracts, another one for storage. And they're very much intertwined, but optimized for those two features. In that case, every time they talk to each other, they'd have to go through the AVA subnet in order to do so, despite having maybe like the exact same miner set.
So this is actually very interesting. So currently the platform chain and the exchange chain, or the P chain and the X chain is what we call it. They live in the same subnet, so we can actually perform operations in a slightly different way. So there are optimizations that you can use if you're two chains inside the same subnet. So as Kevin mentioned, has the same set of validators. That's all subnet really is. So there are like different operations that you can use that would potentially not like involve AVA at all. Now I will preface this, or I guess I will like just mention that like not all of this is currently implemented. So on the atomic swap side between subnets, that's currently not in the client. But intra subnet has been implemented between the P and X chain. So we're working on it. But yeah, this is it's the model.
So technologically speaking, there's no reason to believe that that's not going to be the case. It just hasn't been done yet based on available resources and priorities.
Yeah, I mean, we're working on it. Like we've been pushing like, you know, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for a while. So we're pushing, we're working on it. But I just wanted to make sure that there was no confusion there.
Where are we now? Like what's happened since we last talked, and what are you currently like prioritizing?
So currently we're working on network stability stuff. So we've been switching up our networking stack quite a bit. Previously we had apologies because I'm going to talk mainly about the Go client, just because that's my area of focus. But we've been focusing on switching out the networking stack. We had a C++ networking stack for performance reasons, but the Go garbage collector, it kind of interfered with that and was giving us a bunch of problems. So we ended up switching to a pure Go networking stack. So that was a big change that we've done recently. In addition, we're focusing on kind of bootstrapping improvements and just overall stability. So that's kind of our main focus right now.
Is your new networking stack lib P2P, or are you guys writing something new, brand new there?
So for now, it's just a very thin, like it's a dead simple, basically just Go native networking. It's like not complicated at all. It's basically just, you know, best effort, send a message to this peer if you're connected to it. I know that we've talked internally about looking at libP2P, just because I think that's kind of the go-to. But we were basically looking at getting something up and running as quickly as possible. And so we just implemented a very thin networking stack for now. Yeah.
What are the requirements there? Like, what do you need clients to do in terms of the networking layer? That maybe is there anything different in terms of what requirements you have there when like thinking about like comparing it to other blockchain ecosystems and how they typically talk to each other in a peer-to-peer network?
So for the most part, we just want to be able to connect to each other as well as possible and send messages. Because we're a async safe protocol, the messages don't need to be like guaranteed to be received or anything like that, which of course is impossible to do, but some people try it anyways. But we basically just needed a dead simple communication tool. I know that some people have gone down the route of like using like UDP exclusively in attempts to like decrease message latencies. We haven't really seen a need for that. I think that's for the most part a micro optimization, unless you are extremely network bound, which our consensus protocol basically evenly distributes networking load. Which is, it's very similar to proof of work in that. So for the most part, network is not it's not a very bandwidth heavy usage protocol compared to something like a classical consensus protocol. So, yeah.
But it seems like because of the way Avalanche works, there's usually multiple rounds or multiple times I have to query my peers for a specific, for their state, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So would that not cause it to be bandwidth heavy, or would you only call that latency heavy?
So in consensus, you typically think about like what's the number of messages or what's the number of bits asymptotically that you would you have to send to peers. So for a single consensus decision in Avalanche, that's log n in the number of nodes in the network. However, as more decisions like get added at the same time, we can pipeline that to be a constant time operation. Whereas something like Hot Stuff or Tendermint, that requires a linear complexity. So at least on one of the nodes. So for the most part, the bandwidth is evenly distributed and is relatively relatively low.
I think I the way I've always pictured this internally in my head, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that the way the network scales in terms of load is with the number of decision any given validator has to make. Because every single decision they have to make is based on a multiple rounds of random sampling of their network knowledge. So they say, hey, this group of people, what do you think about this? Another round. Hey, different group of people, what do you think about the same thing? Et cetera, until they come to a conclusion with a strong confidence interval. And that scales really, really well with the size of the network, because the number of people that they're querying and their knowledge of the network is constant over time. It can differentiate because there's more people they can sample from, but it's the same. It's based on what they want to do. Whereas most traditional like Byzantine consensus algorithms scale with complexity because you need to have an answer from everyone. And so as the number of participants grows, the number of messages that pass across the network grows exponentially. And that's not the case with Ava.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. I oftentimes like to think about it is if anyone's taken like a just a intro statistics class, they always talk about, you know, sampling a population to kind of get like some expected value at some interval bounds. And so that's very much the same thing that Avalanche does. So you don't need to sample the entire population to be very confident in what the population believes in a whole. So yeah.
How much of the population do you need to sample, roughly? Like, what? How much of the population do Ava validators sample?
So Kevin can talk a little bit about this because he knows a lot on the math side for like exact bounds. But
what was the question? The exact bound? How many nodes you need to sample?
Yeah, like how many? What percentage of the network do Ava nodes sample?
It's actually not based on percentage. So if you can do some analysis on the hypergeometric distribution. Basically, what it says is something kind of interesting, which is that the error bounds on a particular sample are really only dependent on, well, not really, but let me just say really, as far as, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, statistically significant, really. It's really only dependent on the sample size itself, not on it as a percentage of the network size or anything else. It's just a raw number. So what really matters here is what the sample size is in raw terms. Is it 5, 10, 20, 40, whatever it may be? It's entirely independent. Again, that's not totally true, but really, like, believe me when I say it's mostly entirely independent of the network size. So the network can be a million or 10 billion or 10 trillion, doesn't matter. You can ignore that for all intents and purposes and just focus on the sample size itself, whether that's 5 or 10 or 20. For reasonable parameters, a network, a sample size of about 20 is more than sufficient. If you go to 40, that's really, really sufficient.
And that's like each iteration that you're sampling changes. And so you're not sampling the same people every single time, correct?
Correct. Yes. And each iteration creates more and more. So like there's actually a trade-off mathematically between latency and the sample size initially. So let me maybe make this clear for everybody listening. So let's suppose I start by sampling everybody in the network, which is what typically most proof-of-stake systems work as. So that is what I'll call a deterministic sample. I sample everybody and my error probability on what the true state of the network is exactly zero because I have sampled everybody. I have full information. So in order for me to get probability zero of error, all I require if I'm sampling everybody is a single round. So the latency there is just one round. The way that it works with Avalanche is that you trade off that latency of one round for much smaller sample size. But the really nice thing that's kind of like a Hail Mary from math is that the sample size, while it can decrease drastically, the latency does not actually increase that much, which is a really great Hail Mary. So there is mathematically no difference between sampling, let's say, 100 nodes versus sampling 2,000 nodes. The guarantee there is really, really close to each other, which means that I can just now save 20 rounds. So instead of one round of 2,000 nodes, I can do one round of 100 nodes, and I get basically the same mathematical equivalent. If I drop down to, let's say, 40 or 20 nodes, I get a little bit of error, but I can easily, you know, subsume that error and just completely squash it with just a few additional rounds. So the number of rounds grows very slowly as far as the drop in the sample sizes. And how slowly it drops is actually, it's a complicated formula, but it's really, really small. It's like close to logarithmic, even less than logarithmic. So it's really, really slow growth, which is a really nice property. So a fixed, constant size sample of, let's say, 20 nodes per iteration done over, let's say, 10 consecutive trials would be sufficient for most intents and purposes to provide people with really high security guarantees. And this would be independent of the network size. This is where kind of Ava wins. So given these small numbers, now you can toss at it a network of 1,000 nodes or 10,000 nodes. It doesn't really care.
So given that Ava or an Ava node queries all these other nodes, and it changes the set of nodes for every round that it queries, when I join the network, how does that look? Do I, as a node, just try to gather as many nodes as possible in the beginning that I can change this set? Or every round try to find 20 new peers? What happens there?
Yeah, so this is actually where we diverge pretty heavily from other proof-of-stake systems. Bitcoin, there's the bootstrapping problem, which is different in proof-of-work systems from proof-of-stake systems. Proof-of-work systems, the bootstrapping problem can be solved as long as you connect to one correct node, a node that truly has the view of the network. And as far as that correct node, comes back and says, hey, here's the view of the network, the longest chain, you can verify yourself and you should be good. But once you join the network, validation of transactions still requires that the majority of the nodes you're connected to, or rather the hash power, is correct. So bootstrapping is nice or in proof of work, but it ultimately doesn't really save you much. It's not like you're still getting consensus by only trusting a single other node. So it's kind of a party trick. It's kind of a moot point. It kind of falls flat on its feet. Whereas in proof of stake, other systems have other projects have tried to desperately emulate this whole, one out of n. As long as I trust one single node, then maybe I can connect to the correct proof of stake network, and it's caused a rabbit hole of just insane proportions that we seem to not be able to get out of. People have lost their minds on all slashing and things like that, and it's gotten down a really crazy rabbit hole there. Our bootstrapping mechanism is pretty straightforward. Is we don't care about solving bootstrapping by just trusting a single node, because eventually you're going to have to trust some majority number of nodes. So we assume that when you're trying to bootstrap into the network, you're connecting to a majority correct number of nodes. And as long as that's the case, that assumption holds, which in reality it almost certainly will, then there's a very simple bootstrapping mechanism. All you effectively do is just download the state, get the minimum intersection between these nodes that accumulates to at least that half the identities, and then you suddenly have the list of peers that you can connect to and participate in the network. And then from that list of peers, this is what constitutes the latest active staker set, and that's where you sample from after you join. So that's really our bootstrapping and eventual operation of the network.
Yeah, that was a really good answer. But I think Dean was probably asking on a more like specific technical level, like, does the node connect to all of the nodes at the same time, or does it attempt to kind of discover nodes as needed? Was that what you were asking, Dean?
Yeah.
So the node just eagerly connects to as many nodes as it can right now. As long as the network doesn't become so large that actually causes issues, that's a totally reasonable path. And so that's kind of the route we've taken now. A node can connect easily to like 10,000 nodes or like thousands of nodes with no issue. If we ever get to a point where we have like millions of validators, then that's probably gonna have to get revisited, because it'll probably no longer be sustainable. But as long as the network is like in a reasonable size right now, there should be no issue with like running out of connection file descriptors or anything like that. So that's what we currently use.
So as this conversation was going on, I've always had this mental model of how it works in terms of consensus. And it's occurred to me that it's the consensus version of the central limit theorem. Is everyone familiar with what that is?
Yeah, should I give a that's exactly explainer? Correct.
And so like for those that don't know what that means, it's basically like if you have an incredibly large population and you want to figure out what the mean is, you can do it in a few ways. What you can do is you can do the way in which Kevin just mentioned. You can sample every single person and you have a probability or a confidence of 100%, exactly what that is, but that may be difficult depending upon the size of the number of people you have to sample. And that's what we're seeing as kind of consensus algorithms try and grow with the number of validators. Or you can do it by sampling small amounts of people multiple times. And the central limit theorem states that as you iterate the number of times you sample those people, you converge to the actual mean of the entire distribution very, very, very quickly and with a strong confidence. And that's what you're doing. That's the general idea of what you're doing.
Damn, you really fucking killed me here. Oh, sorry. Am I allowed to
curse? You can curse
here?
All you want. We don't care.
Oh, okay. Jesus Christ. You really, you made this very, God, we need to use you as our technical spokesperson. Yeah, that was a perfect description, basically.
Okay, good. Of like, all that's happening. There's so much confusion about what's going on. And it's not a difficult concept.
It's really not.
It's a trade-off. And what's nice about that is you can parameterize the system in terms of how many people you need to sample with respect to like what latency trade-off you have or like what how fast you get a confidence interval.
Exactly. And here's the nice thing. When you do trade the size for additional latency, you can still do useful work in between each one of these rounds. And that's where the amortization with Avalanche comes in. So it's not like, for example, exactly as you said, though, the drop in the increase in rounds is not like proportional to the decrease in the number of nodes. Like if I go from, 1,000 nodes down to 500, it's not now like my number of rounds goes from 1 to 2. It actually kind of stays at 1, almost at 1. But even if I get to an additional number of rounds, I can still do useful work between each round, meaning that I can do a sample for one particular transaction, and then the next round I can sort of pipeline the next transaction that references that previous one, and say, okay, Corey pays Dean, that's one transaction. Then Kevin pays Steven, that's another transaction. Instead of doing multiple rounds for both of these in parallel, instead I do Corey pays Dean first. And then I do Steven pays Kevin, which points to the Corey pays Steven transaction, Dean transaction. And now I can effectively create a linear chain of these guys, which looks like repeated sampling. So effectively, every single transaction is only sampled once. So it's not even sampled multiple times in a row. It's just sampled once. So you end up reducing the amount of nodes that you sample per query down to just some constant number, very small constant number. And you effectively get a single round per transaction almost for free. So this is where a lot of the magic happens. But you totally nailed it. It's actually, once you kind of get this trade-off, it's super simple. It's like, this trade-off is exactly the reason why the basic primitive of Snowflake effectively is a generalized method of describing basically every single quorum-based system. It just happens to be one where you basically trade off deterministic guarantees with probabilistic guarantees in exactly the same way as if instead of sampling everybody in the set and getting their mean, in which case I have a probability zero of error, I know exactly what the mean is, I can instead trade off some of that guarantee with a little bit of error, but still be pretty damn close to the mean, and I still get a whole bunch of other benefits. So that's where a lot of the magic happens, but it's pretty simple. The math is complicated, but the concept is very, very simple to explain.
Yeah, Avalanche, or at least the consensus protocol family, is really simple, which is one of the reasons why I like it, because it feels like something which anyone who's probably thought about probabilistic consensus or consensus in a tiny distributed system has probably thought of something like this. It's like a very simple method of just gossiping your state and taking a sample size.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this is what the quorum-based systems already do, right? They just happen to do it with the entire system set.
Yeah.
So, Snowflake is a generalized version of all consensus. In fact, if you make Snowflake where their sample size is the network size, then you get one of the first well-known consensus protocols, the Ben-Or consensus protocol, asynchronous consensus protocol from 1983, before even Paxos. It's one of the very first. Which one was the first?
Oh, no. I think Ben-Or was the first, but I'd say you almost get it. The only thing that Snow doesn't have is the the random coin.
Like, oh yeah, so, but it doesn't care about that. So that, but I'm talking just about the quorum property. So
yeah,
it looks very similar to Benor actually. It's a 1983 paper. It was the very first paper that solved consensus in an asynchronous system, and it is from 1983. Also a Cornelian guy actually.
Well, all right. What's next? How do we start to wrap this down? Like, where are you guys going? What are you looking forward to? How do people get involved, et cetera?
Yeah, so we want people to start looking at what we have as far as like what the properties it achieves. I think it's a great time for new systems that have made a lot of noise. Hopefully, like us, to actually stick up to that noise and deliver. I think we will. So this summer is going to be fun. We're going to be launching incentivized testnet next week. We're going to be going towards mainnet this summer, and it's really going to be the fun. That's when the fun really starts, I think. And we get to in production, test this thing out, make sure that it gets some Lindy effects under its belt. It's robust, and we're building lots of applications on top that really, especially benefit from low latency. So. And low transaction fees. So it's you know, I get a lot of haters from the Ethereum crowd because it's like, and I'm going after Ethereum, but that's because it has issues. Like, we're trying to solve those issues. Like, what do you want me to say? So it is where it is. So I'm excited myself at least, and I don't share this view with everybody else at Ava because Ava is a pretty different set of people actually, and we all share different views. But I personally share the view of, look, we have technology that can solve a lot of these issues. And I want to see applications that that are running fast and efficiently in a distributed way on us. So and they're fully backwards compatible with Ethereum and EVM and so on. So that's going to be cool, I think.
On that note, cool. The technology works potentially. It has potential to change a lot of the problems or solve a lot of the problems that we face in the currently implemented systems where value exists. How do you get people to move? Because it doesn't matter if people don't use it and put their value in it. How do you get that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, so to me, there's a certain set of properties that are required to kind of make the secret sauce kind of work and really marinate a little bit. And first property is you need to propose a new system that really has incredibly low switching costs. If you don't have that already, let's forget about the other stuff to begin with. So you need something that has compatibility to the Ethereum virtual machine. The tooling works. The switching costs are super low. Validating the system has even that part has super low costs. You just run on your machine. There is no slashing, none of that. Across the board, there is not a single piece of what we've built that, frankly, I'm very proud of this. Like, anybody can say, wow, this is so much work to get this going. It's going to be compiled all in Go very soon. It actually already is. It's just basically Go run a bunch of scripts. You're already running a node. Boom. There's no slashing on the validator side. It's a very low risk. Running applications on it, it's backwards compatible with Ethereum and so on. Okay, so that's the first ingredient of the secret sauce. And then the second thing is, great, you provided backwards compatibility to your new system. You need to have a reason why people would want to switch ultimately. And that reason is, number one, we have a very fast engine that we can actually back up our claims with. And it gives rise to applications, or rather use cases, I would say, that currently can't really quite exist on Ethereum. Augur, for example, is having massive issues. They can't run certain kinds of trades because of the massive confirmation times with Ethereum. The costs on Ethereum are prohibitive. It's just getting so expensive to run. You know, it's getting clogged down by random stuff that don't matter. So these are all problems. We need to get to that point where, you know, we have 100x better tech. And then it's really a matter of, you know, so we have backwards compatibility. We have a 100x sort of better tech guarantee, whatever you want to call it. And then three, it's all about working with the right partners that accumulate sufficient network effects to be sort of self-standing. And that includes not really working with the well-established partners initially on Ethereum, but with new up-and-coming ones and supporting those guys that are building really cool new DeFi stuff. Really nurture that community deeply. Like, we have absolutely no life, and we don't plan to have a life for the next foreseeable few years until this thing just is self-sufficient and is running and is growing by itself. And that means just really supporting our devs with grants, with our attention, with nurturing them. We have lots of talented people internally that can help out teams. We don't have a whole lot of cash resources as other, you know, maybe projects have raised in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But I think we're still competitive as far as the benefits that we provide. So, you know, that's, I think, the stuff in the secret sauce, and also creating things that just simply don't exist anywhere else as far as applications go. And we have a bunch of those in the pipeline. And then the rest of the final ingredient in the secret sauce, I think, is just a little bit of luck. So hopefully we get that as well, and then we got a good recipe going.
All right. Do you got any more questions?
I had one more, but I don't know if this is going to go on a tangent. You mentioned that you guys don't slash. So how do you do that? How do you handle Sybil resistance? How do you assure that you have all these guarantees without slashing validators or Byzantine validators?
Oh, I can get into hours for this. How much time do you have? What are the guarantees that you want to provide that you think you are providing with slashing?
That's a good question. So the first one will be probably Sybil resistance, right? We don't want.
Why do you think Sybil resistance? BFT systems have been built since the 80s. Precisely to not care about that small percentage of nodes that are misbehaving.
But those weren't Byzantine. Those weren't Byzantine systems in a permissionless environment, right? So the problem is, like, in a permissionless environment, when anyone can spin up a node where it's so easy, how do you ensure that not the majority is Byzantine?
Oh, I mean, that's done via stake, right? So you have to accumulate that stake in order for you to be able to spin up a whole bunch of nodes. You can spin up a lot of nodes on Ava. It's just you won't have a lot of stake attached to them. So
okay, so they're still staking. There's just no slashing of the stake.
Correct. Yes.
So what happens to a misbehaving node? You just kick it out of the system?
No, you just ignore it. It just does its own thing.
So I guess the easy way to say is probably that you don't need slashing because you have this stake, and there's probably a high time for you to be able to transfer this stake to a new node to make sure that other people don't ignore you anymore?
What do you mean by a high time?
Like there's a overhead on you having to exit your stake and then restaking it to get it to another node where you can start misbehaving again to mislead or to be a Byzantine node.
I mean, even if you do that, even if there is almost zero switching cost to that, which that's not true. Even if that was the case, though, as long as you don't accumulate some large percentage of the stake, then it doesn't really matter. You're basically entirely ignoring the system. That's the whole point of BFT systems. So that happens to be the case. I think what slashing does is, you know, prevent those that you know, maybe are thinking about doing misbehavior to not really do any misbehavior. But ultimately, that's really not saving you anything because you already had the BFT protections in place. It's kind of like, I don't know, you put locks in your house and then inside the house, you still have a gun. I mean, you know, it's not a great analogy.
That's not a great analogy.
It's not a great one, but it's like you already have the protections in place. You're just creating additional drama and complexity internally with your slashing. So it's really not necessary. And here's the thing. Ultimately, if you end up breaking the threshold guarantees of the BFT system provides, so the first layer of defense, which is the most important one, slashing does not prevent you, it does not save anything. If I accumulate majority stake in a system, I can actually make the minority stake look like the misbehaving ones, and I can kick those guys out, which is crazy.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. Like, not only have you not misbehaved, you're totally good. I can make you lose all your money because I can make you look like the minority member in the system. So it really saves you nothing.
Yeah. So I guess the protection in this scenario is that the minority just forks.
The minority just forks, yeah. But by definition, that's not really a protection, right? Like you could be double spending. Like how long in a proof of stake system, if that were to happen, you probably would have to have a whole bunch of social, like Skype calls to make sure what the hell just happened, undo transactions, issues have already arisen, and then eventually you somehow fork, which is fine, and you undo all the issues. But I mean, this thing can happen in a system that is also not doing slashing in any case. If you end up going down to Skype calls, then whatever problems you had in a slashing system, you can also solve in a non-slashing system.
Yeah. So one of the people at Ava, Philip Liu, he says that proof of stake is the cockroach of civil control because you can always just fork out the person that's doing the attack and then force them to rebuy. Whereas in proof of work, you could just like switch to a new chain. So I like that analogy.
It's the difference between internal and external resources being staked.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct. Yes.
Which is the difference between proof of work and proof of stake. What I'm interested in, but I don't quite understand, is, and you're right, this did go on a tangent, but it piqued my curiosity here. Like, say we have some type of malicious node in the network with some amount of stake. How much effect do they actually have on consensus if the way rounds work is any individual node requests state from a random sample in the set and then does it over and over again with each of those random samplings changing with each iteration? Like, it doesn't seem like it's very easily deterministic on like how much an individual malicious node can control the state of something going one direction, because you have that kind of like avalanching. I mean, it's called avalanche for a reason, right? Because like the random sampling guarantees that like once you have a tip and consensus in any given direction, it goes that direction very quickly with the number of iterations.
Yes. Yeah. So you would have to have a pretty significant stake in order for you to prevent that tipping over. It's not really in the number of nodes. It's really in the stake that you control. I mean, the point of Ava is that eventually, once the stake is very highly distributed, it could potentially be in the hands of thousands of nodes. Then we're able to sustain that growth pretty easily. So it's future proof.
Ooh, that leads me to another big question, which I've always wondered.
Distribution.
Yes, I've always been curious about distribution of Ava and the underlying assets and then the ecosystem. That is going to have a tremendous effect, especially because of what you just said on consensus.
Of course. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, distribution is huge, it's critical. We're trying to find every single possible source of distribution channels that we can find. We're even considering interesting things like POW, actually. So we might allocate certain Ava tokens to be mineable via POW, and it's kind of like a fair open thing. We can. We're also looking at that work lock type of distribution methods. But the thing here is that basically we're trying to serialize all of these one after another. So it's not going to be everything all at once. There's going to be public sales. There has been some private sales. There's going to be developer grants. There's going to be which actually there are already developer grants. There are sort of more non-developer grants that have happened. There is going to be distribution via these POW and work lock type mechanisms. We are very concerned about distribution ourselves, and we want to make sure that there is not a single person out there that can point it up and be like, oh, this is a pre-mine thing and all that kind of stuff.
They're going to do that, just to get over that.
I know. They're going to do that. But I would love to just be like, yeah, you say that about Ava, except that the data eventually, you know, maybe 3-4 years from now is going to say that it's even more distributed than Bitcoin. So that's my dream. That's really what I want. I don't care about the money aspect of this thing. I want to be able to just be like, holy crap, this thing is more decentralized and more robust than Bitcoin, and put that hat on. I don't care about any other thing that comes with it.
All right. Dean, anything else before we go off on significantly more tangents? Because we probably could.
I mean, I'll definitely message either Kevin or Steven. I've been in contact with them anyways once I have a few more questions, but I feel like our listeners will probably no longer want to listen to all of those.
I mean, for full disclosure, like hashing it out, like Ava is a sponsor of hashing it out as it currently stands. It did not influence any of the questions we have now or our particular interest in it. I think just like our interest and willingness to kind of dive into this and ask questions maybe sparked the ability to get the sponsorship in the first place. But like this is interesting. We care about it. And it's new. And so like that's basically where I want to leave this before my
Are we sponsors? I didn't even know it. Are we sponsors of you guys?
Congratulations.
Oh Jesus.
Dude, I didn't know about this. I was on
that's why we're so
coming
nice.
On here, you know? Like
Oh, interesting, interesting. I didn't even know. I frankly did not know. Well good
otherwise
to know.
We would have gone ETH Maxi on you.
Okay, well next time let's go more ETH Maxi. I wanna handle all the tarred questions.
You wanna argue?
I do wanna do argue, that. Yes. Let's bring some of the ETH Maxis
well,
here.
It's not like, you've been on five times. I'm sure we can bring you back on sometime soon.
Yeah, probably. I need Antipras, whoever that guy is. I need that guy here. That's going to be fun. That's going to be a fun conversation. Whoever that guy is, I need him here. That'd be great.
We'll work on trying to facilitate some panel where we moderate you versus sweet ETH Maxis. Kind of like the...
Oh, Jesus.
I don't know if you and the Nick episode can be that, but more that.
Honestly, no, that was a fun episode. You know, I want to go after actual like full on ETH Maxis just have a batshit insane conversation. That's going to be fun.
Honestly, right. Kevin, I'm kind of happy that you guys entered this space because became more serious with Ava because all the ETH Maxis are no longer on my back. They're all on you guys now. My Twitter experience has been so wholesome, so peaceful.
Oh my God, they're on me. Well, to be fair, they're not bothering me because they can't bother me too much nowadays. I make noise against the Ethereum for a real reason. Like, you just can't say, like, it's very objective noise, right? It's like, look, well, high fees, all that kind of stuff, and there's nothing they can say. Yeah. But
I completely agree. Like, I was commenting on Ethereum a lot because also I just think that ETH2 is practically going to work. And I got some ETH Maxis DMing me saying that I'm not doing good marketing for Ethereum and that's going to cause our bags to dump.
Oh, Jesus.
I was like, that's great.
Yeah.
I don't give a fuck.
This is why I brought Dean on the show.
Okay.
All right, guys, let's wrap this up. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you guys.
Add as much as we can that I remember to add to the show notes. And I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys build and hearing you come on the show again later.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Dean. And thank you, Corey. And also, thank you, John. You've been quietly listening, but thank you for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.